Hey, my name is Rene DeVille, as you've heard, and I'll be talking today about RF technology for broadband K-band communication systems. I'll talk about some generic requirements for K-band systems, and then we'll review some of the semiconductor device types that exist for operation of these frequencies. I'll say a few words about the kinds of technologies that are available to put these subsystems together, and then I'll illustrate you these with some examples. As I mentioned, it's K-band systems, but those little K-band systems, they operate all the way from 23, there's a range of 23, 38, above 40. So I'm going to focus on LMCS, which is in effect at 28 gigahertz, although in the US and Canada we're a little bit different there, so there's some complications we have to anticipate. I'm also going to be focusing on K-band satellites and how they're emerging. You'll bear with me, the system architectures are variable, in many cases very poorly defined to date, and so the specifics of the technology are pretty hard to generalize. I've chosen here some typical generic type of performance requirements for the hub and the NDP on an LMCS system, and I should emphasize, by the way, the focus here is on the consumer-oriented type LMCS system as opposed to a commercial service operation. The hub, we need typically need a fan beam antenna with about 14 to 15 dB to cover a quadrant. This, along with the need for, say, 100 to 120 megahertz drop to the user, translates into about power per channel of about 1 watt. The total hub transmit power then, in order to handle the full 500 megahertz bandwidth, has to achieve somewhere between 4 and 15 watts per sector. This, of course, has to be multiplied by 4 to cover the 4 quadrants. How you achieve those, it can be done either using the single or multiple amplifiers, in other words, a bank of lower power amplifiers, or one large amplifier. If you do one large amplifier, then you have to concern yourself with the tower cable where you place the electronics. Noise figure does tend to be a critical issue, although it's obviously desirable to keep it down to a reasonably low number. On the flip side, the customer premises equipment typically has a spot beam return. The beam is made narrow enough so that the gain is high, but not so narrow that it's hard to install. This results in about a need for about 35 dB of gain in the consumer antenna. And then translating that back to the with the understanding that you're not likely to have the home dropping 100 megahertz from the home back to the base station, you're going to be a lot narrower bandwidth, which implies that you can get away with lower power per channel. Now, I put 100 milliwatts here. The actual transmit hub power amplifier likely will be between 100 milliwatts to 1 watt. Low noise amplifier, again, same sort of constraints. The a dB of noise figure is not quite as critical as a dB of power. The other issues you have to keep in mind is in the connecting between the amplifier and the antenna, you have got to keep those resistive losses very low, because if the losses are high, of course you suffer not only in loss of gain, but you also suffer in a reduced in a degraded noise temperature. And of course, the most critical parameter for the CPE, and the one that really drives, I believe, this system, is the need to keep the cost of the CPE low. On the flip side, for K-band satellites, I should comment, by the way, there's 55 submissions right now on the boards for K-band satellites, wideband K-band delivery systems, LEO and GEO, representing a total of about 729 different satellites in orbit. Obviously, there's a substantial interest, and I must admit, though, there's about 288 of those are all teledesic. So, The GEO systems, as you can see, are not quite the same as LEO in terms of bandwidth allocation. There's a different way the spectrum is allocated. The LEO systems have a 500 megahertz contiguous bandwidth, which is somewhat more convenient. You'll note that the ERP of the GEO has to be a little bit higher to overcome the greater distances. The LEO has a lower ERP requirement, which can be achieved either with which can be allows you to take advantage of a smaller antenna or lower power, However, it turns out the actual link requirements are still such that with a typical antenna of, say, 0.65 to 1 meter in diameter, your beam is still too narrow to allow it to be a fixed antenna. So you end up having to steer the antenna or increase the power, and neither one of those solutions will work on its own. So at present, the demands on the LEO terminals are quite high. The other element, of course, is because it's now narrow beam, you have to either steer the antenna in some fashion. You can do this mechanically, or using phase shifters, or switched antenna systems, all of which, of course, add a level of complexity which has to be somehow overcome. And you'll see with the electronics later that if you try and do this using classical thinking, which is a phase-shifted steerable antenna, you very, very quickly run afoul of electronics. Something now about the kinds of devices that we have. Well, first parameter you have to meet, of course, is the semiconductor device gain. And this graph illustrates the current devices. Now, I should reinforce the device that really is the device of choice at present is the Gaudi Marstein PHEMT. It gives you the best gain, noise, power, combination, performance, and is probably the best understood, most stable process. And you can see that in this graph. The Gaudi Marstein FET, which of course is the historical device that's broke ground in the microwave area, has quite a reduced gain in this band. However, it's much cheaper than the PHEMT to date. This may change over the next few years, but that lower cost may actually allow it to be used in deployment of the CBE type of operations where the cost is so critical. I'd say a few words about the emergence of these devices. Well, first of all, I should comment by silicon itself now has the silicon processes themselves can go above 25 gigahertz in cutoff. I don't show them here, but they're to be watched because Nortel, I know, offers a process that gives a cutoff frequency in excess of 25 gigahertz. So this is starting to look showing some potential for encroaching on the turfs of the gallium arsenide. The silicon germanium device, however, is the one that's emerged. We have a local company here called Sigi Microsystems that, in fact, does offer this kind of service developed and based on an NRC developed process. And I know Nortel is working in this area. There's substantial interest in this area around the world because the main driver being the cost. Silicon germanium devices built on CMOS type of substrates can realize as much as a factor of 4 or 5 improvement in cost or decrease in cost if you can achieve the performance. So there's a lot of interest. You'll notice the red curve, the silicon germanium HBT curve there appears to have performance comparable to the gallium arsenide PHEMT, and it's a bit misleading because this device actually has to be fabricated. It's based upon a German developed process, and it has to be fabricated on the high resistivity silicon, and this tends to drive the cost back up again. The next parameter is, of course, I mentioned noise figure, not quite as critical in these, nevertheless still very important. You notice at the bottom here this curve for best indium phosphide, very exciting if you can achieve it at a cost-effective level. Unfortunately, right now it's still at best a lab curiosity in very, very special areas. Some research is going on in this area at NRC, I know, and there is a lot of promise for this in the future. At present, the workhorse device is still the Gaudi Marstein PHEMT, as you can see here. It gives the lowest noise over the band of interest and is likely to stay that way for some time in terms of a cost-benefit for noise figure. The silicon germanium, it's all over the place. Can't quite tell where it's at yet, but I've done a bit of fooling around here to show where it might end up at based upon current capabilities. The gallium arsenide MESFET loses steam at the Ka band, and it's still the device of choice for frequencies less than about 12 gigahertz, since it's a much lower cost device. The third, and probably the most important parameter, the most demanding parameter is the power performance. And I've shown only three devices here, the Marstein HBT, heterostructural bipolar transistor, the PHEMT, and the MESFET. And you can see again that the PHEMT is by far the device of choice. in this frequency band. The gallium arsenide HBT is emerging. It's starting to, its performance is starting to improve. They are particularly attractive in oscillator applications since they have very low close-in phase noise. And so they're likely, will in as the technology matures, you'll see components emerging with both HBTs and PHEMTs on the same functional blocks. The MESFET, of course, is there again, but it's a substantially lower cost. Single device powers of, with PHEMTs have been achieved as high as 5 watts on a single device. However, these are a bit of a curiosity at present. They're still not commercially available. And the low cost, the cost and attractiveness of PHEMT power amplifiers is really in the 1 to 2 watt range for the LMCS bands. I've done this table. I don't intend to go over this whole table, but I've done this table. Sort of summarizes the previous view graphs in terms of a comparative assessment of current performance. Performance, I would say, current maybe up to mid last year. The point I want to show is that the one at the bottom of the cost, and by far the silicon germanium HBT shows the greatest promise in terms of cost. However, its other performance factors are not quite good enough or stable yet. To achieve acceptable performance in this frequency range. The device of choice, as I've mentioned several times, is really the gallium arsenide PHEMT. Now I'm going to say a few words about integration technologies up here. There's a couple others which I'll allude to a little bit later on, but these are the four basic ones that people are looking at. The one up in the upper right-hand corner you'll recognize is the monolithic microwave integrated circuit. It's basically a fully integrated functional block, and amplifiers, oscillators, mixers, up and down converters. You'll see examples of that at the conference, done entirely in semiconductor. Of course, it's the smallest. It lends itself best to large volumes, but as you'll see, there's problems when you try and go into a higher level of functionality in a single gallium arsenide chip that drives you into other technologies. The cost, of course, is the key one in gallium arsenide. It's an expensive process to produce the monolithic circuits in. The one to the left is the miniature hybrid MIC. It's been used a variety of substrates, makes it very versatile. It has all of the process steps that gallium arsenide semiconductors have, except for the active device. The active device is purchased as a chip. And as such, of course, this makes MHMIC very attractive as a carrier for monolithic circuits. And this is, in fact, what is emerging most rapidly. Glass MIC is a very interesting evolution. It's a proprietary process to MACOM, but it's an ingenious use of glass because glass has an extremely smooth natural surface and therefore allows you to make high integrity capacitors quite nicely. Silicon, on the other hand, has a high thermal conductivity as a substrate, therefore allows you to place hot devices on them. The process itself is actually quite cheap. Unfortunately, it's not likely to find widespread use since MACOM really is not sharing the process, is not licensing the process to anyone else. On the lower right-hand corner, I think this is the most exciting breakthrough in the past few years. It's the emergence from the low frequency, from the digital circuits field, the multilayer green ceramic area. It's called low temperature co-fired ceramic. It's hard to see in this picture, but that structure actually consists of about 20 layers of ceramic, interlaced with patterns for DC feeding, for RF feeding, for capacitors, inductors. They're all placed in those layers. You can also put a recess, as you see in the little white box on the left-hand side of that block, a recess where you can place other devices, maybe put a ceiling on them to shield them from the outside surface. The solid block down through the middle shows a heat post that goes from the top to the bottom. You can use backside, front side. Very, very versatile technology. And really what it does is you take layers of green ceramic, punch holes through it, cut shapes through it, do what you wish, metallized pattern it, sandwich all the layers together, and then fire it all at one shot. And the final unit is a block that essentially functions. Very attractive technology, emerging very rapidly now, and being used in the cellular and GPS areas already. And it's starting to be looked at quite seriously at 28 gigahertz. Technology is not quite mature at 28, but it is coming along very rapidly now. This table sort of summarizes some of the comments I've made in terms of performance features, heat sinking, yield in particular. Now, I've included monolithic microwave integrated in circuits in this layer, even though really I don't, as you can see, the cost, in the cost row, I've referred to it as a high cost, and people say this is not, this is unusual, MIC should be low cost. But as a full integration medium, where you actually try and put all of your circuitry onto a into a final unit with connectors, it really does not emerge very well, because when you start doing this, you get large chips, which means that your circular wafers have a lot of wastage at the edges. Secondly, because if any single parameter in that large function fails, you throw away the whole chip now. So the yield, of course, decreases quite rapidly. The result is that you really want to put a series of functional blocks in there, maybe two, three chips, and then interface them to the outside world using one of the other technologies. So, so as a full functional unit, MYC is likely not going to be there for a little while at least. I've added multilayer soft substrate, low temperature co-fired ceramic I've mentioned, but multilayer soft substrate is actually very attractive. It's getting very very good usage, and I believe it's being starting to be applied in the LMCS area in particular. The key issue there is, I think, is to keep the cost low, and that tends to drive you into the automatic bonding and wire bonding and chip attachment area. And if you're going to do that, then you have to have a very specialized process. And the soft substrates themselves are not natural when you do die attach and wire bonding. It is possible, but it's not a smooth process yet. I won't bungle. It's a table that sort of summarizes some of the electrical parameters. It's in the paper, and it shows, if you go through it, it shows that pretty well all of the mainstream integration processes are able to meet and provide the performance, electrical performances that you need to achieve at Ka band. A few examples, and you'll bear with me if I focus on CRC. It tends to be a little bit nice to be parochial once in a while. These particular chips were designed at CRC, 1-watt MMIC chips built on the what was Westinghouse became Northrop Grumman, I think is becoming Lockheed Martin any day now, process. These chips have actually been built into a commercial unit now. In fact, ITS Electronics, I don't know if they're represented here today, but ITS Electronics is now marketing this amplifier, a 1 to 2 watt amplifier. They have both 1 and 2 watt amplifiers based upon these chips. So as you can see, the sizes are quite small for these kind of chips. This is an interesting one. This is actually Texas Instruments LMCS chip. However, this particular process has now been sold to TriQuint. What I want to note here is that in the gain curve, you see 25 dB for a three-stage amplifier, and that represents something between 8 and 9 dB per stage of gain, and that in effect agrees with the table if you look back earlier. I want to also note on the right-hand lower graph, that spike that you see in the blue curve is the carrier interference spike, and it's in effect a representative of a phenomenon which no one has managed to eliminate in power MMICs, power PHEMs, and it's known as gain expansion. And for whatever reason, it causes that it has a change, a nonlinear portion in the gain curve, which causes that kind of interference characteristic. Noise amplifier from the same people, and you'll notice that the gain now for three-stage devices dropped. And of course, the reason why that happens is you're now matching for noise, not for gain. And you really seldom get to where the noise match and the gain match are identical. But again, it's you're getting the noise figure, which the curve suggested about 3 dB is a legitimate noise figure for devices in this band. Another example of a component that might be useful in the LEO systems, where you need a steerable antenna, you need switches or phase shifters, and the basic element of both, of course, is a switch. And in this case here, what we have built, what we designed was a switch, which is actually designed for a wireless LAN, indoor wireless LAN unit, which you'll see later. This particular switch actually broke some ground in terms of noise. In terms of loss, it was less than 0.8 dB loss at 28 gigahertz, and gave over 30 dB of isolation. So that's again is a component that could be useful in the LEO. This is an example of miniature hybrid. You'll see the recesses where the devices sit. In this case, transistors. That's, of course, where you could place a monolithic circuit. And in fact, that's probably the most exciting application and most common application of it now is to insert monolithic circuits and package them into a larger structure. This is a unit in which a half-watt amplifier chip, the monolithic chip, has been inserted and is interfaced to the outside world using thin film ceramic microstrip circuits. And then, of course, those are then interfaced to the outside world through connectors. There's a poster session on this particular development. It's a K-band direct IQ demodulator chip developed, and the principle behind this, as you'll see in the poster session, is to try and eliminate as much RF hardware as possible. This particular system allows us to demodulate directly from K-band down to the baseband, and thereby eliminating several intermediate steps of electronics. I show this as an illustration. It's a phase shifter which uses the chip, is based on the chip, and we have built it based on the chip, the chip switch that I showed earlier. What I want to note here, though, is that it takes eight monolithic chips to make this 4-bit phase shifter. And you can understand why, therefore, it's highly unlikely that the classical phase shifter driven or steered antenna will ever become practical at these frequencies. Quite certainly we'll have to find better solutions than this to meet the steerable requirements of LEOs. Lastly, I'll wrap my talk with this one here. This is a project which is cooperation between several universities, CRC and Nortel. The unit is a wireless LAN, indoor unit, wireless LAN unit, designed to operate with switch beam 155 megabit per second wireless operation in building, and it contains in the little T, what appears to be a little T on a white strip in the near the antenna, is actually several of those little switches as you saw earlier, and allows you to switch not just to each of the antennas, which is now four different antennas covering the quadrant. It allows you to also switch, receive, and transmit. And it's actually quite an ingenious combination of these switches in this case. There's a low noise amplifier on the one single little black dot on the top, and there's a driver, 100 milliwatt in this case, driver amplifier on the bottom. The lower piece is the up and down converter circuitry and chips. So with that, I'll...